So mu1 decay was a mu minus, we always calculate the decay rates in the rest frame of the particle, nu mu. I guess you could do something else, but who would really do that? So that's the tree-level Feynman diagram. And as we noted last time, this is a three-body phase space. So we have to do what we did for two-body, work out some of the integrals. And we did that last time. And we ended up with d gamma d. So there's three energies for the three final particles, E1, E2, E3. And we did the integral over one of them and over the angle between the two other momenta. And we got left with these two integrals to do. And it's the invariant matrix element squared. And that could be the spin-averaged one, for example, depending on the situation. Or if they're all scalars, there's no spins. And it was 64 pi cubed ma. And then we talked a little bit about the Dalitz plot that you make to learn about the shape of the invariant matrix element in energy space, and how that can be used to figure out if the decay is quasi-two-body, a very important thing to know, since many decays are quasi-two-body. But now we want to go ahead and use that formula to calculate the muon decay rate, and I'll just sketch that out for you. So we want to calculate the invariant matrix element, and we use the Feynman rules. So there's a G2 over root 2 in each of these vertices, according to the covariant derivative, the part of the covariant derivative involving the charge W bosons. Yeah. So it's G2 over root 2. Huh? Well, I'll pick two of the energies. It's up to me which two I pick. Yeah. Oh, sorry. So this is in general. And in our case, MA would be the mass of the muon. That's correct. Thank you. So this is going to be squared. And then I have U bar P mu. I'm starting here. And then I got gamma mu, and then I got u of p mu. So I started at the end and worked my way back, the usual thing. And the only tricky thing here is that if you look at the Lagrangian, they were all left-handed fields. And so I get a 1 minus gamma 5 over 2. And I'm going to put that 2 in here, and there'll be another 2, which I'm also going to put in here. And then I got u bar, the momentum of the electron, gamma nu, 1 minus gamma 5, the anti-electron neutrino momenta. And then I got the propagator for the W boson for a massive spin 1 particle. And so I got minus I, eta mu nu, the metric that contracts these two, minus q mu, q nu over m W squared and Q squared over. So that's it. That's the whole shebang. And so far, we've been machines. We've taken the rules, and we've written down the answer for the invariant matrix element following the rules. You could teach a machine to do that. But we're better than machines. We're physicists. So we can not only follow the rules, we can make approximations, throw away the stuff that contributes bubkis, and keep only the biggest pieces. We're better than machines. I'm trying to pump you up. Okay, what can I neglect? The muon weighs like 100 MeV. Much less than the W boson weighs. W boson's like an elephant. Muon's like a mouse. Tell me some things I can neglect, set to zero. Come on, class, there's cash on the line. Hold on a second. I got to get into my pocket. Oh, jeez. There's a lot of stuff in here. Keys to my apartment. Oh, it's like a million quarters in here. What was I doing on the weekend? Oh, I know why. The roll of quarters broke. Okay. Come on, tell me something I can neglect. Yes. That's actually not true. It's not true. Because the energies, for example, are set by the muon mass. I can't neglect the muon mass. But in this formula, this Q squared is set by the muon mass, right? Q is the momentum flowing through this line. Sorry, I should have labeled that. Q is the four momentum flowing through this line. So this Q squared is of order the muon mass squared. It varies over the phase space a little bit, but it's always of order the muon mass squared or smaller. So we can neglect this. More Qs over MW, we can neglect this. And we can also neglect the mass of the electron and the neutrinos. Well, so far as what we've done in the standard model, the neutrinos are massless, but they actually have a little mass. So another thing that's done is we introduce a symbol called the Fermi constant, G Fermi. And by convention, G Fermi over root 2 is G2 squared over 8MW squared. And then we square up the matrix element. We write it in terms of traces like we did according to the rules we did before.
Bye, board. Oh, you're so high. Oh, my God. That's high.
So we're going to average over initial spins, sum over final ones. And so I got GF squared over 4 trace Okay, so we got to do those traces. So some of the traces are the ones I already talked about, which involve 4 indices, 4 gamma matrices traced over. And some of the traces are 4 gamma matrices in the gamma 5. Yes? Yeah, same diagram. Yeah. So I have to decide, which one's going to be particle 1, which one's going to be particle 2, which one's going to be particle 3. So the ones, the energies I'm going to integrate over, the one I'm going to eliminate is this one. I'm going to integrate over these two energies, electron and its antineutrino. And so we're going to have two types of traces, one with 4 gamma matrices, one with 4 gamma matrices and a gamma 5. The one with 4 gamma matrices and a gamma 5, I'm presuming you've seen that trace before and what its value is. If not, I'll give it up on one of the TA sessions. But it's anti-symmetric in the indices, and therefore it's anti-symmetric in these two momenta, and therefore it would give you something anti-symmetric in the two energies. But the energy integral is symmetric. And so you get, that just goes away in the total decay rate of the muon. See, yes?
Why in this trace stage are you talking about integrals over energies? Are you looking a few steps ahead?
I'm looking a few steps ahead. We're always looking a few steps ahead. We're going to take the trace, we're going to plug it in that formula and integrate over energies to get the total decay rate. So when we integrate over energies, that's a symmetric integral. And this is anti-symmetric in the energies, the part with the gamma 5. So we're just going to throw it away for the calculation of the total decay rate. Yes?
Why is the gamma lambda?
Because I was hallucinating. Hold on a second. Oh, I forgot one. I guess it's here. Yeah, should be both of them. Okay, so it's straightforward at this point. So keeping only that symmetric part, we can do the traces, and I'll tell you what I got. You can check it. Maybe I'll give it as a to be worked out later. Neglected the electron mass. So that's the thing we got to do the integral. Now we got to integrate over the two energies. The energy of the antineutrino, I always forget the bars here, but over the antineutrino, electron neutrino energy, and the electron energy. So we're going to do them one at a time, right? So first we'll do, let's say, the 1 over the neutrino energy. So in order to do that integral, I have to know the range of that integral. The final integral over the electron energy will just go from 0 to mu over 2. But I have to know the range of the neutrino energy integral at fixed electron energy. Right? I'm doing a double integral. So the limits of integration, they always come from these extreme points in kinematics where things are lined up with each other. So what's the configuration that gives me the minimum electron energy? Well, that ends up the minimum nu e. That ends up, so when you have an electron, when you have a mu nu, and the electron antineutrino going parallel. So if it's going parallel, then it looks, I mean, these are both massless particles in our approximation. It looks just, you can call them one particle then, and it looks just like two-body decay. So the energy of the muon neutrino will be mu over 2. And then by momentum conservation, ee plus e nu e is e nu mu, and so in this configuration, E nu E is equal to mu over 2 from here minus EE. And this is not the energy in general, this is the energy in this kinematic configuration which corresponds to the minimum. And the maximum is when you have nu e bar here, and the others recoiling against that, and that's e nu bar equals mu over 2. So now that we have the ranges of the integrals, we just integrate that polynomial, and you get that the muon lifetime, gamma mu, is equal to G Fermi squared, the mass of the muon to the fifth power, over 192 pi cubed. Very famous formula.
Excuse me, sir. Did you miss something in the third term? The dimension is not correct.
Oh, yeah. It must be squared. Let me check against my notes. Thank you. It's wrong in my notes. I'm guessing it's squared. But if it's not, I'll correct it next time. Thanks. Okay, so I'm not 100% sure about that. If it's not right, I'll fix it next time. Okay, so that ends the section on the standard model at tree level. And now we have to go on and discuss how to do things beyond tree level. Tree diagrams are the Feynman diagrams that don't contain any loops. And from the tree diagrams, you can read off all the Feynman rules that are used to compute loops. So you might think that we're good to go. But there's one more subtlety, and that subtlety has to do with divergences in quantum field theory. So in simple scalar field, I understand you've already discussed at least a little bit the fact that you have to renormalize the theory. If you have a quantum field theory, what happens is that it's a quantum field theory of particles, and those particles, they interact at points, and when those points get close together, you get divergences as they approach each other. So those divergences are coming from very short distance physics, very high energy physics, physics that we can't probe experimentally. And if we couldn't handle those divergences, if we didn't know where to put them, if we couldn't absorb them into some definition of something, then everything in physics would depend on the things at the highest possible energy, the shortest possible distances, which we can never test experimentally. It would be chaos. It wouldn't even really have laws of nature. It would be hard, you know. Usually we think we don't have to know, we don't have to do experiments at the Planck scale to know how to predict, you know, what happens when you fire a cannonball. So we have to be able to remove those divergences and absorb them into the definitions of parameters that we measure at low energy. Otherwise, we won't have predictive power. We know from experience, from the fact that there's so many physicists in this world, that we have laws of nature and they have predictive power. So how it works is we've written down our theory at tree level with many parameters in it, many coupling constants, many masses, many fields. And when we compute, we get divergences, and we're going to absorb those divergences into the definitions of those coupling constants and field. And when you can do that with a finite number of quantities that you're absorbing the divergences into, the theory is called renormalizable. You don't need to know about any very short distance physics. It's all absorbed into the definitions of the parameters. So you've already done that for scalar field theory. There's a few complications in doing it with gauge bosons and fermions. So we want to go over that. And plus, we want to use modern methods. We want to use dimensional regularization, minimal subtraction. There's nothing wrong with using a cutoff, which I understand is the way you did it before. But in gauge theories, it's really very difficult, very technically challenging to use a cutoff. And that's because the cutoff itself, because it's a momentum cutoff, breaks the gauge invariance. The gauge invariance are space-time dependencies, and the cutoff has to do with space-time, because it's a momentum cutoff. And so for technical reasons, which I won't go into detail, it's actually pretty hard to use a cutoff. People invented other ways, like polyvelars. But the simplest way, computationally, you've got to be fast. You know, you got to write that paper. There's a lot of other people that might write that paper. And even if you're working on a real hard problem where no one else is going to write it, you got to be fast because you're going to work on a lot of wrong things and you got to go through them. So you want to know the method that really is the easiest to use, which is dimensional regularization. So we're going to go ahead, we're going to renormalize the standard model at one loop using dimensional regularization. Too long, too much time. Let's start with quantum electrodynamics. Talk about renormalizing it at one loop. And then I'll say, well, it goes more or less the same way, yada, 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 except I'll tell you where some of the real qualitative differences are. So everybody up for where we're moving now? Okay, so let me start with the Lagrangian. So we're just going to do quantum electrodynamics. One fermion, which you could think about as the electrons and the photon field, and we're going to renormalize that theory at one loop explicitly. We'll do the calculations, or I'll do almost all of them. And you'll finish one or two that I don't do. So here's the Lagrangian. The QED doesn't mean we're done. It's quantum electrodynamics. Here's the field strength tensor. And there's the covariant derivative, but I'll write it out explicitly. Whoa. Mass of the electron. Okay, so does that ring a bell? Dingy dongy, dingy dongy. Looks good? Yes?
Why is this zero?
Oh, I'm supposed to not have zeros yet. It's because I got ahead of myself. Thank you. There, punish myself for that. It hurts. No zeros. That's the Lagrangian. That's what you write down. What am I going to do to that Lagrangian? It's got fields. It's got masses, it's got a coupling constant, and those are the parameters in the theory. And I said, we're going to get divergences, and we're going to absorb the divergences into those parameters. So I'm going to have two sets of parameters, one that I call bare, where I haven't yet absorbed divergences into them, and the others that I call renormalized, which are the ones after I absorb all the divergences into them. So here we go. Let's rewrite. This is the original Lagrangian we start with. It defines a theory. We haven't done anything. We haven't absorbed squat. We've got a theory. We actually haven't defined a theory yet. Because of the divergences, we have to regularize the theory. We have to define it so everything's finite and then absorb the things that would diverge in a certain limit. So with a cutoff, it's pretty easy to understand. What we're going to use is dimensional regularization. So we're going to work in four, not in four space-time dimensions, but in four minus epsilon space-time dimensions, really close to four. It's so weird. Anyways, okay, so we've regularized the theory. We have bare parameters. Look at those pink zeros. Look at those pink zeros. Ta-da! We haven't done anything but put a pink zero on the stuff. And say we're going to work very close to four dimensions, whatever the hell that means. Oh, I swore in class. Could lose this job over that. And then you'd be sad. Okay, so remember what the field strength tensor is. F mu nu, not or not not. Whew, that's a great phrase. But you can put a not everywhere if you want. That's the field strength tensor. Okay, so one thing we got to get straight, we always got to get straight, are the dimensions of things. So we already know in four dimensions, the coupling constant E is dimensionless. The mass of the electron has dimensions of a mass or an energy, because we said H bar equals C equals 1. A nu has dimensions of an energy. That's the dimensions of all the quantities. But we're not working in four dimensions. We're going to work in four minus epsilon, or in n dimensions. So I got to get straight the dimensions of everything in n dimensions. Otherwise, it's hard to do dimensional analysis. The dimensional analysis is the most powerful thing known to a physicist. Okay, so the guiding principle is always that the action S, which now will be the integral dnx of the Lagrange density, is dimensionless. Because we stick that over h bar, and then we get the amplitude, the quantum amplitude, due to Feynman and Dirac. And here, n will write as 4 minus epsilon. And you might think, how am I going to calculate in 4 minus epsilon dimensions? I don't know what to do. I'm so confused. I just want to pack up and go home. Don't despair. What we're going to do is we're going to work out the formulas for general n. N equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. And then we'll just have that as a function of n, and we'll write n like this. We'll pretend it works for all the n's, even in between the natural numbers. I'm sure there's a very sophisticated mathematical argument for why this is correct, or why you're able to do that, or why you're able to deduce that. But I'm not going to talk about that here. I'm not going to mention the words analytic continuation. Oop. Okay, dimensional analysis. So let's start off with something simple like this. So I'm going to use the same notation as before. If I put a bracket around something, it goes, what happens if the thing has dimensions mass to the power p, the bracket on it stands for the p. Okay? So from this terminal Lagrange density, what do I get? I have two derivatives, so that's a 2. I have two, so it's this story. I have two A fields, so I get twice the dimension of the A field. I have dnx, that's minus n, and the whole thing is dimensionless. And so A, dimensions of A, are n minus 2 over 2. So that's equal to 1 minus epsilon over 2. So not quite 1 anymore at n dimensions. Everybody got that? Let's do one more, and then I'll just write out what you get for the rest of them. Is that okay, class? Okay, they're pretty simple. Let's do the size. The size. So to get the dimensions of the size, what I'll do is I'll use this term with the derivative, and then I'll have enough information because I have dimensions of the a's and the size to get the dimension of the coupling constant. But I'll just write that one down. So for the dimensions of the size, I have one derivative, so that's a 1. I have two psi's again, a psi bar and a psi. That's two psi's. Oops, I should put the 0 on these. It won't matter. It's the same thing. And minus n is equal to 0. So the dimension of psi is equal to n minus 1 over 2, or 3 halves minus epsilon over 2. And then from this, we can deduce the dimensions of the other things. So the dimension of me naught is equal to 1. And the one that's sort of funny, well, I don't know if it's funnier than the rest, but this one is 2 minus n over 2, which is epsilon over 2. So the usual coupling E is dimensionless. And even though we're okay, so that's the dimensions of quantities. Let me, look at that. I didn't struggle with the boards at all. They all came out the way they're supposed to. I think I deserve a round of applause for that. No, I totally botched this one. Well, the pressure's on, you know. I have a great story about the pressure on, but unfortunately no time to tell it. It happened like when I was 10, but I still remember it. It's like a... Anyways, maybe over dinner sometime. Okay, so those are the bare quantities. And what we're going to do is we're going to introduce renormalized quantities just by just multiplying by a number. You can always do that to find your new fields by multiplying by a number. So there's ZA, A mu naught, psi equals 1 over the root Z psi, psi naught, and E. The renormalized coupling, even in n dimensions, we're going to keep that dimensionless. And so all these are going to be dimensionless. So I'm going to call this 1 over ze. Is it really ze? Yeah. Okay. And then there's psi naught. And psi naught has dimensions of... dimensions of epsilon over 2. So to make this dimensionless, I'm going to introduce something with dimensions of mass mu, and it's going to go to this power, so that now this is dimensionless. And mu has dimensions of mass, or energy. Yes?
Should it be instead of psi naught e?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I have to give you a quarter. Kind of a weak, kind of a stupid thing to write down, but. Yeah. So much for your tryout for the Dodgers. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so. Yes?
A few questions. One is, why are we so concerned with making E dimensionless and not so concerned with.
Yeah, well. It's really because when we calculate Feynman, so I haven't really told you why. When you calculate Feynman amplitudes, these parts just sort of go away on the outside, but the powers of E stay there in the series. And so it's convenient to have this be dimensionless. These all go away in terms of propagators, but the E's stick there in terms of a power series if you calculate a cross-section. So it's convenient to have your power series expansion in terms of a dimensionless quantity. You wouldn't think it's, and it's useful for other reasons, that it's going to enable us to derive what are called renormalization group equations, but you'll see more as you go on.
And all the Z's are dimensionless?
All the Z's are dimensionless. And we'll calculate some of them. You'll see explicitly what they look like. They're going to be used to absorb the divergences. So the idea is that if I calculate time-ordered products, expectation values of time-ordered products of renormalized fields, and express them in terms of the renormalized coupling E, they're going to be finite as epsilon goes to 0. And the divergences are going to be absorbed in these quantities, which will diverge as epsilon goes to 0. But that means we just absorb those potentially divergent quantities into the definitions of the quantities in the theory. And there's similarly one for the mass of the electron. There's mass renormalization as well, which I haven't written down. Pardon?
What did you say is the name of the mu?
It's called the subtraction point. So mu is called, thank you, is called the subtraction point, and it's arbitrary, right? We can pick it any way we want. Pick it to be the mass of an elephant, if you want. It ended up, if you were calculating E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus at an energy, maybe twice the muon mass, and you took mu to be the mass of an elephant, your power series expansion for the cross-section would look awful. It wouldn't converge very well. So there will be convenient values to choose mu. But if you could sum the whole series, the theory is independent of mu. It was just introduced. There's no mu in our original Lagrangian. So it's up to us where we choose it, what value it has. But we should make our, if we want to do perturbation theory, we should make our life easy and choose mu so the perturbation series is as well behaved as possible. Yes?
Why is it called the subtraction point? Is it because it subtracts dimension?
It's because in some sense it goes into helping to define what the finite part is versus the infinite part of a diagram. So I don't know how you did it when you did cutoff. You know, if you have a cutoff and you calculate a Feynman diagram, you get a log of lambda squared. And the finite part, you could call the finite part the part without the log, or you could call it the part without the log plus 6. It's still finite. So you have to have what's called a subtraction procedure to uniquely define the theory. We'll talk about that in a moment. And mu is associated with that procedure, so it's called a subtraction. Any other questions? So let's write out our theory now in terms of the renormalized quantities in the Z's. Let's write out the Lagrangian again. So this Lagrangian, all we've done is redefine things. We haven't changed the theory at all. It's still the original theory we had, defined in n dimensions by this Lagrangian. So what does it look like now? So no more knots. I got to put this mu to the epsilon over 2. I really hate this. Looks kind of strange, doesn't it? And now there's the mass renormalization, which I didn't, and I just left out there. It's the same as the others. Plus them. Okay, so all I've done is rewrite things in terms of renormalized quantities, E, ME, and the renormalized fields. Well, that doesn't look so much like QED. Let's write it so it looks like how we're used to it. Well, we'll set all the Z's to 1. That's a lot of equations for not doing anything, actually, because all I've done is rewritten the theory in a different way with these definitions. So far, we haven't done too much, but it'll look like magic shortly. So we're still working in n dimensions. We're always in n dimensions. So usually you write it like this. Well, these aren't the same, right? Then I got an equal sign here. Half the time when I write in the board, I leave the equal signs out. Sorry about that. But this time I actually wrote it in. And they're not equal. We're missing something, right? This is ZA and this is 1. And the stuff we're missing, we call the counter terms. We just write it like this. As if they don't matter. They're there. But let's write out what they are. Let's write out L of the Lagrangian for the counterterms. CT, counterterms. So many of them. Z psi, Z E, root of Z A, minus. So all I've done is subtracted 1. This looks so strange. That's what we did. Okay. So remember, our goal, how we're going to choose the z's, is to remove the divergences in time-ordered products of these renormalized fields as epsilon goes to 0. And as I mentioned before, there's lots of different ways you can do that. They're called subtraction schemes of different ways. Sorry, I'll get it up so you can see it.
Gone to heaven.
What are the divergences going to look like? Well, I haven't shown you this because I haven't done any of the integrals yet that you get from loops, but I claim that the divergences you get, we're calculating in n dimensions. Nothing is divergent. The divergences occur as epsilon goes to 0, just like when you work with a cutoff. It's finite. What we call the divergences occur as the cutoff goes to infinity. So now what happens when we compute the time-ordered product, some Feynman diagram, the expectation value of the time-ordered product of a collection of fields, what we're going to get in those amplitudes are powers of 1 over epsilon. So as epsilon goes to 0 and we approach 4 dimensions, those would become infinite. And so what we're going to do... to make the theory finite, and what it's called minimal subtraction, is we're going to choose our z's to have the following, so they could be a power here too. At one loop, it's always 1, but at higher loops, you get higher power. So z is always going to have this form. So z is always going to have this form. I'm not going to take anything else and put it in to z. In other words, I could have had some finite term. I could have added e squared log of 4 pi minus the Euler constant over 16 pi squared. I called z this. Maybe with a 2. Yes?
So what's the z key?
Pardon? Zp is a power series in the coupling constant.
Oh, E.
Yeah. So it's some function of E. And it's called minimal subtraction because I never do stuff like this. I just take the poles in epsilon and put those into what I call Z to make the things finite.
Doesn't it have a poles in?
1 over epsilon to a power? Is it, if you viewed it as epsilon as a complex number, so it's a pole? course, epsilon is just a real number for us. But so we're taking the poles in epsilon, that's all, and putting them into the z's. And you could put different things in. There's different subtraction schemes. Yes?
Let's say, earlier you said that we would do calculations just for integers, and then afterwards plug in 4 minus epsilon.
Right.
It seems like
we're already using that here. Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm imagining we've done that. We've looked at our function of epsilon. We've pulled off the part that looks like this, and the rest is finite. Okay? Yes?
Is this the only possible divergence form when
this is all you'll get with dimensional regularization, yes. And we'll do it at one loop explicitly. You'll see where it comes from. Yeah. So you can analyze the diagrams and the type of loop integrations you get, and you can show that.
So Fourier is somehow a special dimension, because would theory be automatically renormalizable in 3 dimensions, less than 3?
Yeah. Well, we can go to different dimensions, and what happens is it's not renormalizable when you have coupling constants that go like 1 over a mass. And so, you know, the dimension of things change as you change dimensions. So, in lower dimensions, it's more convergent, so it's easier to make it renormalizable. In higher dimensions, it's more divergent, and there aren't many renormalizable theories in higher dimensions. For sure. We could have a problem on that, actually. It's not a bad thing for a problem. Yeah, it's because the fields, basically, it's, you know, inside a Feynman diagram is an integral dnq. The propagators are always 1 over q squared, and so the bigger the dimension, the more divergent things are. It's kind of paradoxical, because the one theory that's finite, or one of them, they're finite theories in low dimension, but one that's finite is string theory, which is not a field theory. It lives in 10 dimensions, but it's actually finite because it doesn't have point interactions. The divergences all come from when the points overlap. I'm sure you'll hear about that at some point if you haven't already, if you're in the string theory class. Okay, so we got to compute. We got to start to compute. There's another subtraction scheme, actually, that most people use. I guess I have to mention it. So this is called minimal subtraction, MS. Most people don't use minimal subtraction. They use something called MS bar. And to get the answer in MS bar, what happens is there's extra logs of 4 pi and factors of the Euler constant that are subtracted. And that's because you get these things when you compute in the finite part of Feynman diagrams, and they look so artificial. They have to do with this working in n dimensions, and that you just subtract them away. They always occur in the same way. And operationally, you can do it by taking your subtraction point here, and then you can just shift it to e to the Euler constant over 4 pi. And if you do that, if you first calculate an MS, then you do that, it's called the MS bar. But I won't say very much about that. For purposes of our lectures, we're just using MS. But I'm telling you, in practice, if you read some paper and they're calculating something physical at one loop, they'll almost always use MS bar. But it won't matter for us. Okay, so we got to know how to do loop integrals. We got to know how to do 2 things, one of which I assume you already know, and one of which you don't know. So basically, the one loop Feynman diagrams, they're all going to be able to be put in this form. They're one loop, so there's one integration over a loop momentum. So it'll be a dnq, 2 pi to the n. There'll be a q squared to the alpha. And there'll be a q squared minus m squared to the beta. So, I mean, for some values of alpha and beta, this integral exists. It's finite. It's a function of n. You can compute it. Of course, you have to know the solve for n equals for, you know, some values, and you have to know, you have to be able to do the solid angle in n dimensions, but you can do that for the n's you understand, and then use the same formula. You can use that stat mech trick if you want to get that. If you haven't seen it, I'll give it on a homework or during one of the TA sessions, and so this is what you get. Oh, and you also got to rotate Q-naught integral, you know, all the things you do for that you did in the scalar case. Make sure I wrote it out because we're going to use this formula a lot.
Could you just raise the board a little bit?
I'm going to raise the board. Let's see if I wrote it out right. I over 2 to the n pi over n over 2 minus 1 to the alpha plus beta m squared to the alpha minus beta plus n over 2. Gamma alpha plus n over 2. Gamma beta minus alpha minus. Okay. So the gamma function, if it's gamma of a negative integer, for example, it's got a pole there as we approach that. So the only place that 1 over epsilon poles can come from are from this gamma function, and they'll be simple poles. And all the one-loop integrals are of this form. So at one loop, you just get 1 over epsilon as the divergent part, times something, times e squared times something. We want to know those somethings. The other thing you got to know how to do, which I assume you did in class, is you got to know how to combine denominators. So if you have 1 over a, b, it's equal to the integral dx from, oh, what a funky x. So if we have a product of propagators, we use formulas like this to combine the propagators, and you can generalize it to 3 propagators. They can be combined, etc. So have you seen this already? No? Okay, so I'll give that on for not this. You're already full for this Monday, but for Wednesday, we'll fill in a few of those steps for the Wednesday TA. So. You can do this integral explicitly and check that this is true. And that's usually called the Feynman trick, even though it was invented by Schwinger. You know why? Because who could understand Schwinger's papers? They were so complicated. You've got to write simple papers. I believe that's actually true. So let's go on. We got to compute something. We got to compute something hard, because we're tough. This is psi, right? So we're going to compute ZA. ZA. Where are you, ZA? Jeez, there's a lot of stuff there. Yeah. So ZA lives in front of the field strength tensor squared in the counter term. So what are we going to do? So what kind of time ordered product of fields would that contribute to? It would contribute to the time ordered product of 2A mu's, because that terminal Lagrangian has 2A mu's in it. So we're going to calculate the time ordered product of 2A mu's. There'll be 2 contributions. One from that counter term. And the other from the one-loop Feynman diagram. We're going to add them together. We're going to demand we get finite as epsilon goes to 0. And given that z is written in this way, that will determine z, the z that we need, the z, what do I call it, z sub a? Yeah, z sub a. Pretty straightforward. We calculate two Feynman diagrams, we add them up, we expand as epsilon gets small, we look at the 1 over epsilon pole, and we choose z1 for a, za1 in this expansion, so that this is finite as epsilon goes to 0. This is the key. This is what you do. And if you wanted to renormalize at 2 loops, 3 loops, 4 loops, 5 loops, it would always be this at that appropriate level. Wow, both of you at once.
Does this integral come from all these loops diagrams?
Which integral? This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll see it more explicitly. It comes from loop diagrams like this. So this one here, for example, this loop diagram here would have beta equals 2, and then be terms with alpha equals 1 and alpha equals 0, as you look at the terms in the numerator. And if you do more complicated diagrams with more legs or more loops, you can get, you know, more complicated integrals, more powers here. Mm-hmm.
What do the different diagrams correspond
to? Okay, so this is the usual one loop five. Oh, dang. Coming down. Okay, so this is the one loop Feynman diagram that I'm going to deduce from this theory by, you know, using the usual Feynman rules at the vertices. And then this counter term here, this starts in order e squared, because all the z's start like 1, so this starts in order e squared, and so I'm going to treat it like a perturbation, and I'm going to add the two together. So I should have said that's before, thank you. So this is from the counter term, and it's of order e squared. I know that because it's got to cancel this, which is explicitly of order e squared. Is that fine? Observing judgment. Okay.
Did you say that z itself is of order e squared?
No, z minus 1. Z starts off like 1 always, and the difference is of order e squared. Okay, well, let's work on the counter term. Let's work on this part first. Sorry, a little slow today, but it's kind of an important lecture. They're all important. It's a standard mode. We're beyond tree level now.
In general, does a Feynman diagram with a loop that has an X over it denote counter?
So this is just to note that it's a counter term, right? That's the notation I'm going to use when I insert a counter term. Different people use different things. This is not a loop in any sense. It's actually a tree calculation of that vertex. Okay, so let's expand out the counter term vertex. Basically, what I'm going to do in this class is I'm going to do this example in complete detail, and the others I'll just say how they go. Otherwise, we'll never get past this. But this one we will do it so you really see how it works. And I'll give you homework to help you along with other or TA session, I haven't decided yet. Minus a half, ZA minus 1. That's just the factor. And then I got to write this out. So I could write this as d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And because the quarter went to a half, I can just take one of the terms here. Sorry. Okay, so we've got to label our Feynman diagram. There's momentum P coming in. There's our vertex. There's the mu for the four-vector index. And there's a P, and there's a nu. And, of course, there's propagators on the external legs. We're not going to write the propagators down. Sometimes people say they amputated the external legs. Yeah, you get to feel like you're the right kind of doctor to perform amputations, at least as far as your parents are concerned, at least if your parents are old-fashioned. But we're actually the right kind of doctors. Okay. Well, you're not doctors yet. You will be. Let's go on. I think I'm getting myself into trouble. Okay, so to get the Feynman, to get the diagram, what do you do? It's either the I, L. There's an I. That's good. There's a minus a half. There's a 2, because each of these photon fields can destroy, or can be responsible for each of these legs, either create a photon or destroy a photon. So there's a 2. There's our ZA minus 1. And then we got to use the following fact. For an incoming momentum P, a derivative makes minus I, a d mu makes a factor of minus I P mu. And for an outgoing momentum P, a derivative makes a plus I, a d mu, P mu. And so we got 2 of these derivatives, so we're going to get plus I and minus I. If you have a plus I and a minus I, you got no I's. And then there's 2 types of terms. There's this one where the momenta are dotted into each other, and the Lorentz indices are dotted into each other. So I get an eta mu nu here. And then there's minus the one where the momenta are dotted into the to the photon field or the polarization vectors. So that is what we're going to write down for this Feynman diagram. Using the usual application of Feynman rules and not writing out the propagators on the external legs, so-called amputating the external legs. And now we're going to compute the one loop diagram, also with the external legs amputated, and add the 2. Yes?
Wait, where did the I and the 2 come from?
This I came from the fact that it's either the I, the action, that you use to derive the Feynman rule, so that's an overall I. The 2 here came from the fact that you think about the Feynman diagram, it's these photon fields that are either going here or here, and you can put either one of these photon fields here. That's a factor of 2. And then this is just the ZA minus 1 and the other things that I discussed. So that's one half of the problem. One half of the problem. Now we've got to work on the harder half of the problem. I got 1 minute left. There's not enough time to do that. And so I'm going to sing for you the potential class song to take up this last moment. So I'm hoping this will last beyond my year. How many of you know Johnny Cash? How many of you love Johnny Cash's music? Okay. So I can't sing, unfortunately, but you'll all sing it with me before this term is over. You ready? So this class is over. There's like 60 seconds left. I can't sing. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling round the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in PI Institute, and problem sets keep coming on, but that train keeps a-rolling on down to Hamilton. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, child, always be a good one, don't ever play with Hamiltonians. But I did a problem set in Reno just to have a try. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I'll bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars, but I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a-moving, and that's what tortures me. Well, if they freed me from this institute, if this railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it over a little farther down the line, far from PI Institute. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away. So I'm going to make this next problem set really long, and then you'll have the TI institution. Okay, we're going to do this computation next time. It's a very instructive computation to do, and then I'll mention how you do the others, and we'll move forward. Have a great rest of the day. I'll see some of you at lunch.